Now, from Mayo Clinic, it's Medical Edge Weekend, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. Plus, we'll take you beyond the headlines for in-depth discussions of what developments in medicine mean to you. Information you want from specialists who know. Join the conversation by phone, through our blog, or on Twitter by going to radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McCray.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, the year is almost over, and 2012 was an exciting, eventful year. From Syria to Egypt to the presidential elections and then the David Petraeus affair. You know, 2012 has really had its share of big stories.
And there were also some big stories in the field of medicine, and we've picked several. We didn't have time for all of them, but several that we think are important.
One of those is concussions, and we'll talk about concussion with sports medicine specialist and sports psychologist Dr. Ainsley Smith of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Dr. Sandhya Pruthi is an internist and breast cancer expert, and she will join us to talk about advances in the treatment of breast cancer based on breast cancer type. If you know exactly what type of breast cancer you have, the treatment can be tailored to the type of
breast
cancer.
That's where genetics come into play, so important.
Right. And one of the biggest stories of the year was the Supreme Court upholding the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
Yeah, we're going to talk with the Division of Government Relations at Mayo, Kathleen Harrington. And there was some really good this year. Good news this year. Several popular, expensive drugs lost their patent and went generic. We're going to talk with Mayo pharmacist Dr. Amy Cipolla.
And we'll tell everyone which drugs are now cheap.
If you're using them, you know.
That's
for sure.
All right. But first, you know, it's that time of year, and you are a living example of the common cold. It's cold and flu season. And, you know, last week we talked with an expert from the CDC, Dr. Breezy, who told us about the flu. And, of course, he said the number one thing you can do to prevent the flu is to get the vaccination. And he told us about the different kinds. And the interesting part was if you hate needles, you can get
the nasal.
Yeah, you can get the nasal, or you can also get the one that they just did the teeny little
needle.
And if you're a senior citizen, you can get the super shot, because as you get older, your immune system tends to get a little bit weaker, so you get a double dose if you're a senior. So this week, though, we want to talk about the common cold, how to prevent the common cold. And on the telephone with us is infectious disease expert and cold expert, Dr. Abhinash Virk. Dr. Virk, good morning. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Good morning to you, too.
Now, we know that you were recently quoted in Good Housekeeping magazine in an article that it was entitled, How to Almost Never Catch a Cold. And tell us what your tip
was. Maybe I promised too much.
Your tip was what?
One of the tips was to eat yogurt or maybe take probiotic supplements.
Probiotics. Now, that's a supplement that you can get in a vitamin store or a supplement store, right?
Yes, over the counter.
And what's the rationale?
Well, there's quite a bit of rationale. As you know, probiotics in the form of yogurt or other such drinks have been taken by older cultures for a long time, and there's always been this old wives' tale that, you know, probiotics or yogurt helps in immunity or helps keep people healthy. And so over the last many decades, there have been a lot of studies that have started to look at this question and said, well, is it a myth or is it actually real? And as it turns out, you know, through numerous types of studies, whether, you know, these are lab studies or animal studies or and lots of human studies, have looked at probiotics and found that they actually do, in fact, improve what we call body's immune responses. You know, they improve what we call natural killer cells, and they have numerous other immune modulation effects that we believe then translates to helping people's general immunity, but also then specifically helping in certain diseases such as the colds and stuff.
All right, but probiotics and yogurt contain bacteria, and
yes.
Colds are caused by a virus. I can see how taking a bunch of bacteria in that won't kill you is going to improve your immune system against bacterial infections, but how does it help against the common cold?
Well, because the immune activation is kind of a generic immune modulation, so it changes the cytokines and natural killer helper cells and produces interferon gamma, and all of these are non-specific. They don't just affect bacteria, but they also affect viruses. And so, yes, numerous studies in humans have now shown that probably yogurt is not going to maybe prevent completely getting the cold, but it might decrease the duration of symptoms and the severity of symptoms probably.
All right, so you need a lot of those killer helper cells, and if you've got some of those, it'll help kill the common cold virus as well as other bacteria.
Now, I borrowed Dr. Shive's issue of Good Housekeeping magazine and saw something else right below your tip about eating yogurt about halo spray. And Dr. Shive said that you were going to be looking into that a little bit more. Can you tell me about that?
So halo spray is basically an antiseptic kind of spray. It is available in numerous other mouth rinses that are currently available in stores and also in healthcare environments. It's very similar to another product that we use in the hospital. It's called chlorhexidine or Hibiclens. We use it a lot in the hospital. So the company that brought Halo out essentially is marketing it as a spray, and their belief is that if you cause a barrier protection within the mouth that kills these bacteria and therefore bacterial viruses and therefore people have less disease. So you could do a mouth rinse or you could do a spray. I think probably would have the same kind of effect. The study that the Halo is based on is actually based on very small patient numbers, at least the one study that I've seen. So, it's helpful. Certainly any small effort you do to prevent getting a cold would help.
All right, vitamin C?
Vitamin C may help, but there's not a whole lot on that. So there's no clear evidence that it actually, taking vitamin C is going to, make a major difference. You have to take a large amount, and if you take too much, it can cause harm. So, if you take a gram a day or less, it's not going to be hurtful to you. It may help you. But again, there's not definite evidence that it, helps.
All right. Wash your hands a lot and get a lot of sleep, right?
I'll do it.
Okay. Dr. Abhinash Virk, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Time for a short break. But coming up, we'll talk with concussion expert Dr. Ainsley Smith. She's a sports psychologist, and she's in the Department of Sports Medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Concussions. You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Dr. Tom Shives, along with Tracy McCray and various guests this week, talking about the top medical stories of 2012. Joining us by telephone is concussion expert Dr. Ainsley Smith. Dr. Smith, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning.
Tell us about the renewed interest in concussions. Why? Why did it take us so long to figure out that these may be more serious than we thought?
Well, that's a good question. I think when you talked about the top stories, I think hitting the news were that prolonged time that Crosby was off the ice in hockey, and then the death and shooting of the Junior Seau, Dirk Bogarde, and the chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And then in Sports Illustrated, even this issue, I think it is, the MIPS, a multi-system protective liner for helmets, is in the news. So there's just so much breaking forth. And I think what that trickled down to was the realization that even the children are sustaining so many concussions, and so those numbers have just a huge impact. So I think there's a lot of concern right now, and we also have to think about how to prevent, you know?
Well, isn't it interesting that when I was growing up as a kid, if you had a concussion or you got dinged,
you got your bell rung.
Yeah. You went right back in, and nobody thought it was that big a deal. But it turns out that's not the case, right?
You know, there's so many folks who have had that experience in all kinds of different sports, not just the collision sports of football and hockey that we would expect it. But I think we are understanding things so much more about the brain now, and the very, very rare cases of second impact syndrome are worrisome. And I think we've learned that the kids really should come off and get time to be evaluated properly and not get sort of thrown right back in. So, but yes, everybody's who was active in sports has had sometimes when they've been, you know, definitely not necessarily lost consciousness, but at least, as you said, dinged or had their bell rung.
Do you have to be knocked out, Dr. Smith, to suffer a concussion?
No, absolutely not. In fact, of all of the concussions, those who've lost consciousness are in the minority.
So what typically happens then when you suffer a concussion?
Well, as you know, the brain tissue sort of jams forward against the skull and back, and so you have the results of this sudden deceleration, sudden accelerations. And then really important in the sport concussion area are the rotational accelerations, that elbow to the head, that shoulder that comes up, and almost like the punch in the boxing ring, and the head can kind of spin, and you have a diffuse axonal injury sometimes where the axons are stretched, and that sets up a horrible metabolic kind of a response, and that's those are in fairly serious ones, but to some degree that what I'm talking about is what happens.
You know, I think it's very interesting that you are doing baseline examinations, mental tests on these kids before they go into their athletic endeavor, and then if they get their bell rung, if they have a concussion, you don't let them go back to that activity until they get back to baseline, right?
Well, yeah, that's actually, Tom and Tracy, this is whole thing, as you know, is evolving so quickly that we just get a little protocol that our docs and our trainers are following, and then there's changes. And, for example, the impact testing is one you hear so much about, and it tests the brain from several different perspectives, and folks thought it was necessary to have that be a baseline. And then when the kids did come in, one of the evaluations, not immediately, but once their brain and their symptoms had kind of subsided a bit, they could be tested to see how closely they were approximating baseline. But out of Zurich, Mike Stewart was just there for a few weeks ago, and I think now those baseline tests will not be a have-to. I think they're feeling that there's enough baseline data available in pools of data for this age group and so on that they will be maybe not putting quite so much pressure on the baseline test.
I have a myth or matter of fact for you, Dr.
Yes.
Smith.
You know, I would have changed that one.
Well,
would you mind?
I actually was going to change it, actually. I know you prepared a great one, but I've got do concussions increase the risk of dementia or Alzheimer's?
You know, in animal models, it really looks as if yes. And the trouble with all the work on the chronic traumatic encephalopathy right now is it isn't usually diagnosed, of course, until postmortem. And so what they really need now, and they're trying to get, are prospective studies through the Boston Group and so on, where they could follow in life the athletes and so on who are taking a lot of exposures, and then use the postmortem as a final confirmation. Yet, yes, this was developing, and symptoms were coming, and it has evolved to this tau protein deposits and stuff at postmortem. But we can prevent a lot of this, and we're doing a lot of research at Mayo in some very exciting work, and we're collaborating with colleagues all over the world, really, and a lot of it is going to apply to the military and populations way beyond sport. But we can also emphasize sportsmanship and use a program that rewards, you know, good behavior on the field, on the hockey ice, if we really make it work. And so I think we have to demand fair, fast, fun play and keep the kids in the games, but have the games structured so that they don't have to have the big hits.
Dr. Ainslie Smith, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for all your great work.
Well, thank you. And you guys have a great day and Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much. Okay. Dr. Ainslie Smith, sports medicine specialist, sports psychologist, Mayo Clinic in Rochester.
Something to watch coming up in 2013, that's for sure. This summer, the Supreme Court ruled the individual health insurance mandate was constitutional, which then was upholding of President Obama's Affordable Care Act. Medical institutions such as Mayo Clinic have been wrestling, that's a fair way to put it, with the implementation of this program. Joining us to discuss this is the chair of the Division of Government Relations, Ms. Kathleen Harrington. Welcome to the studio, Mrs. Harrington.
Thank you, Tracy.
Well, yeah, good to have you because, you know, being a physician at the Mayo Clinic, sometimes we don't even know there are people like you around. And I'm glad to know somebody's working on this and somebody really understands the Affordable Care Act. And that's one of the great things about being a physician at Mayo is that you're worrying about that and I'm not. But we all want to learn about it because it's obviously coming. It's close. Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. What does it really mean for an institution like Mayo?
Well, I think it's a huge challenge for an institution like Mayo, Dr. Shives, but it's also not in isolation. We have to remember that the Affordable Care Act is going to be implemented amidst the fiscal cliff, the huge federal and state deficits we're facing, private employers demanding lower health care costs. So the combined effect, I think, is a great challenge to institutions like Mayo Clinic. And as you know, Mayo Clinic is devoted to teamwork-based care, integrated care, leading the way in this. And that's a lot of what the Affordable Care Act wants to do, is really drive a more integrated model in America. However, the concern that institutions like Mayo has is we've already done that. And we could end up being, in similar institutions like us, being penalized for the affordability that we've already driven in the system. So it's really important for government officials to understand, as they implement this, that we are different. And the one-size-fits-all reimbursement system may not be the most fair or the most appropriate and could certainly impact consumers and patients' access to the kind of care that Mayo Clinic offers. So we are really making sure we communicate that message loudly and clearly to the president and to the Congress.
Well, I think we all think that it's wonderful legislation in terms of allowing more people to have access to hopefully good medical care. But the overriding concern for everyone is how are we ever going to pay for this? And one of the most controversial components is known as the individual mandate in this law, and it requires all Americans to purchase health insurance. But if you don't purchase health insurance, then presumably you're going to be fined, right? Either a percentage of your income or $695, correct? Is that
certainly that's the philosophy behind making and how we're going to get people to abide by the law and the mandate, which the Supreme Court did uphold. The critics, however, of the ACA say that this fine really does not have enough teeth in it to really allow for total enforcement. So there is some concern about that. But the upholding of the mandate does hold together the insurance principles that are underlying the ACA.
If that's one of the most controversial components, I have got a myth or matter of fact for you that is probably one of the scariest things for people, which is a myth or matter of fact, a secret government committee, also known as a death panel, will be created to make end-of-life decisions about people on Medicare.
I think that is such a myth, and unfortunately a myth that has more teeth and legs than the other parts of the ACA, but it is clearly an unfortunate myth.
It's one of the things used to scare people about
it
this whole process.
It is used to scare people, and I think it's connected to some of the other parts of the ACA where if government can't make decisions on reimbursement, then it may be put off to a non-governmental panel. But that has bipartisan opposition. It's very different than a death panel, and it probably will not survive. Because we do go now from into this operationalizing of the ACA. And there will be a lot of reforms that come along the way as we move through this almost decade-long period of operationalizing the ACA.
It seems to me like one of the concerns for institutions like Mayo is that obviously the amount of reimbursement that the government gives to Mayo is not often as high as private insurance companies. And that as more and more people have government insurance, either by Medicare or Medicaid or Obamacare, that the insurance companies are then going to say, well, you know, we're paying too much. We shouldn't be paying that much more than what the government is reimbursing you for. And that will make it very difficult for us to survive, won't it?
Absolutely. Right now, half of Mayo Clinic's patients are Medicare, people with Medicare. We welcome them. We really value their coming to Mayo Clinic. However, the government only covers about 60% of the cost of treating those patients. So we have made up that through the commercial, through transferring of payments from the commercial side. As private employers get more and more squeezed, they are going to reduce their rates. This could be problematic to organizations like Mayo Clinic that do the top of the tier treatment of patients. So yes, there's great concern, and I think Mayo Clinic's leadership is committed to maintaining the high quality standards while driving greater and greater efficiencies in clinical practice.
And that's going to be difficult, because that's been one of our problems is how to make medical care affordable. And this may force us to do it, and hopefully we're up for the challenge.
I believe so, and certainly our leadership is driving for that as we continue to educate the government on how we are different, and we do not want to be impacted negatively by the ACA. Consumers and patients must always have choices like Mayo Clinic.
Well, hopefully that Obamacare will work to our favor rather than against us.
And it's fair to say that it's probably the first step and not the end of the road. It's the beginning of the road.
Oh, I think it's definitely the beginning of the road. And remember, this bill tried to really do quality, affordability, and those are big goals for a short period of time.
You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Ms. Harrington, thanks so much for being with us. Coming up, more guests. You're listening to Medical Edge Radio. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with a look at health and medical news. Are bacteria making you hungry? That's what researchers from France are asking. They've known for a long time that bacteria in your gut is important for digestion. Now they've discovered a possible other role that bacteria may play: control over hunger. You see, bacteria in your gut respond to nutrients you consume and hormones. This communication affects neurotransmitters, such as those that determine your mood. Researchers wonder if bacteria in your gut do these things. Might they influence your choice of whether you reach for bananas instead of bacon? Well, they're developing experiments to try to figure that out. This research was published in the Journal of Bacteriology. And here's some good news for coffee drinkers. A new American Cancer Society study shows people who drink more than 4 caffeinated cups a day had about half the risk of dying of oral pharyngeal cancer compared to those who only occasionally or who never drank coffee. Researchers say coffee is one of the most widely consumed beverages in the world, and it contains a variety of antioxidants and other things that may help to protect against development or progression of these cancers. And this was published online in the American Journal of Epidemiology. And here's some other cancer-related news. Many people who have been through cancer and its treatment have trouble with recovery because of severe debilitating fatigue that can last for months or even years. But according to a recent Mayo Clinic study, even though a variety of treatments exist for cancer-related fatigue, few doctors are recommending them to patients. Study author Dr. Andrea Cheville says it's a matter of balancing rest with easy strength training.
A number of us wanted to be able to prescribe rest for our patients. So we coined rapid and easy strength training. And this is a very simple program. It was designed for patients receiving cancer treatment because that places them at a very high risk for loss of muscle bulk and power. And once that loss begins, it's very hard to gain ground again and recover that.
And in other news, sibling spats. You might think they're pretty normal, and they are. But researchers at the University of Missouri say those squabbles over things like personal space, unwanted borrowing of clothes, or even whose turn it is to play a video game can lead to depression and anxiety. They say violations of personal space and property can cause lower self-esteem later on. But They say parents can learn how to bring peace and encourage healthy psychological development of their kids. How? Set house rules. Things like knocking on a sibling's door before entering and define limits on video game use. But if one child seems to always get his or her way over the other, parents may need to step in. And if the problem becomes intense, seek professional help. And that's a look at Health and Medical News. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Information you want from specialists who know. This week we are reviewing the top medical stories of 2012.
At least a few of them anyway. Late this summer, the latest research into the genetics of breast cancer provided valuable information which should, in turn, provide more successful treatments for breast cancer patients. Joining us to talk about this new typing of breast cancer, the genetics of breast cancer, and what it means is Dr. Sandhya Pruthi. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us what, there's four types. We learned that this year. We had you on earlier to talk about that, but explain how typing a breast cancer makes a difference.
Right. Traditionally, for years, we've always just looked at tumor size and nodal status, if the lymph nodes were involved, to make treatment recommendations. But what's really happened is, what fuels the cancer? What's the genetic makeup of the tumor? And these terms are now kind of being put together into the biology of cancer. And understanding that better can help determine the specific treatment for that specific type. So, for example, one type is known as the triple negative, where the hormone receptors are negative, estrogen is negative, the progesterone is negative, but the HER2 is another genetic makeup of the tumor that is also negative. And this type of cancer has more of a targeted therapy where they would use primarily chemotherapy is one. But let's say someone has a type of cancer that includes the estrogen feeding receptor, the progesterone receptors positive, but that HER2, which is another genetic makeup, is negative, then it's a more favorable tumor and they may benefit from hormonal treatment, not chemotherapy. So that's what our physicians are trying to now is categorize these tumors into these certain hormone feeding genetic makeup.
The genetic
features.
Piece of it. So do you figure out that genetic piece by doing a blood test or by taking an actual sample of the tumor?
Right. And that's an excellent differentiation to make. And it's all about taking a sample of the tumor to determine the hormone receptor and the HER2 gene.
So that would be the biopsy, which you can usually do with a needle. Are you finding that this is a much more complex disease than you ever thought?
Very much so. And breast cancer has become more what they call a heterogeneous disease. There's so many different features to the different cancers that are critical in understanding how we're going to treat that tumor with the specific drug at the right time. And that's what patients need. And that's what they want. Treat sure. me with the right drug. Don't over-treat.
Now, at this point in time, you have broken down breast cancer into four different types or four different groups. Do you suspect that as you learn more that there may be 100 different types of breast cancer?
Oh, I'm sure there will be more genetic, the genetic makeup of the tumor cell. We're going to learn more about other proliferation markers that cause a cell to proliferate and more
proliferate or grow and grow, divide.
Divide, yes. Mm-hmm. And all these markers will become part of the features that we want to understand, what's making this tumor grow like it does and or more aggressive from one that's less aggressive.
And then you will hopefully be able to tailor the chemical treatment, the chemotherapy, to what you've learned about the cancer itself. And that's going to be difficult, isn't it? I mean, you want to be able to get the best treatment for that particular cancer. I mean, you only have so many drugs.
Right. And you talk about the drugs that the patients receive, there are side effects. So patients want to know, is this drug the right drug for me? And what do I have to weigh with this treatment side effects? And so you want to make sure you're giving her the drug that's not going to cause another problem by using something that may not be for this specific cancer type.
In past years, we've learned about the BRCA, the BRCA. And that is determined by a blood test.
Correct.
And we're talking about, as you said, you know, taking the genetic piece exactly from the tumor itself. What can you figure out differently from the blood test than from the tumor test?
Yeah. So the blood test is determining if someone carries a breast cancer gene that's known as the commonly the BRCA1 or the BRCA2 gene. And that's telling us that this is a hereditary predisposition to the breast cancer. And that's why it's a blood test, which is very different. And we don't order that test for every patient. We bring that into the discussion based on their family history, multiple affected relatives, young onset, there's some ovarian cancer in the family. Then that is when the understanding the genetics of that person's family history may play a role in how likely are they to have a recurrence in their future.
And how likely are they to develop cancer, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so there are only certain people for whom, certain women for whom you would recommend getting this genetic test. But I suspect you have women come in all the time and say, I want that gene test, right?
We do. And we do need to sit down and formally take a good family history and understand what age was the diagnosis and what type of cancer that individual had. And this is where our genetic counselors have a very important role in helping to draw the family pedigree. And when they look at the tree and they use some genetic models to put this family history detail into it, determine, is this a family that is more likely to express the genetic mutation, then offer the test and understand that there are sometimes risks to having a test or limitations. So what are we going to do with that information? Some families find that more disturbing, that they don't want to know, or others say, I want to know, and if I knew it, it would make a difference in how well you may want to prevent my risk of getting breast cancer. So it does require a time spent. It's not an emergent decision, but it has to be well thought out.
Are you convinced now that knowing which type of breast cancer a woman has does indeed allow you to tailor the treatment better, which then results in an improved survival?
I agree. Absolutely. I think that's where we are. We're already doing that, but I think we're going to get better.
So the improvements are coming in a lot of places. There's using that blood test to help know what to watch for based on your family genetics. There's using the genetics of the tumor itself to figure out one of those four types, in the future even more types.
Right.
And then there's the advancements in chemotherapies that are helping in those different typing. And those chemotherapy advancements are making a lot of strides too, correct?
Correct. Very well said. And that's what, when a patient comes into the room and meets with a physician, the oncologist wants to pull all that information together and say, we're going to individualize this treatment to your specific situation.
So this is all a lot of chatter right now, though, to someone who has not been diagnosed with breast cancer. And when someone is, a family is completely rocked.
Oh, yeah.
And so what are our women survival rates at this point? How much have they improved?
Significantly. And early detection obviously plays a big role in improving survival rates. And it's always back to getting your mammogram or knowing when to pursue that something different is on your breast exam. That's contributing to the improvement in survival. But certainly the medications we're using and the targeting it and individualizing and tailoring it specific to the tumor has improved the survival.
And what is the survival overall? The woman comes in with breast cancer and doesn't matter what type it is. I mean, some are bad, some are big, some are small. Overall survival, what is it now?
So it's early stage, late stage. So for earlier stage tumors, stage one, stage two.
That means tumors that haven't spread.
Haven't spread.
To the lymph nodes or elsewhere.
Right. The survival is close to 90-95%.
Wow.
All right, but of course, women are still very concerned about it. It's the diagnosis they don't want to hear, even though heart disease kills a lot more women than breast cancer does. Myth or matter of fact, all women have a 1 in 8 chance of getting breast cancer.
So that's a myth. Not all women. It depends on where they are in their age and their lifetime. So if you live to 80, that's where you're going to have the 1 in 8 chance of getting breast cancer, because age significantly increases your risk of getting breast cancer. But if you're in your 50s, you have a 1 in 50 chance of getting breast cancer. If you're in your 30s, you're like a 1 in 25 chance of getting breast cancer. So this is not all women. It depends on where you are in your age.
Very good.
So it's only when you're in your 80s do you have a 1 in 8 chance of getting breast cancer from that point on.
Right.
All right. You know, that's good news. You've given us nothing but good news for the women of the world. Dr. Zandia Pruthi, breast cancer expert and internist at the Mayo Clinic, thanks
so
much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And another one of our becoming more frequent guests, we met her last year at about this time, is our pharmacist who is joining us, Dr. Amy Cipolla. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Hey, Amy, good to talk to you. And you are, where are you?
I'm in Dallas, Texas today.
Oh, that's good. Well, you know, the reason that we wanted to talk to you is because we know that there are about 4 billion prescriptions filled in the United States every year. Americans spend more than $300 billion a year on prescription drugs, but 7 of 10 drugs, prescription drugs, are now generic, right?
Right. There have been a large number of drugs coming off patent this year specifically, and they're calling it the patent cliff. So
I hadn't heard of the patent
cliff.
That's
the only good cliff we've got.
Yeah.
And it seems like probably the most eagerly anticipated one was in February, I believe, when Lipitor became generic, eligible for generic status. Did that make a huge difference for a lot of your patients?
It did. So there was already a number of statins that weren't on patent. So there were some generics, but for the people that were on Lipitor, it made a big difference. So the price dropped by about say it was $300 to about $100. So that's a huge price drop. And if you have insurance, maybe it went from, you know, a $50 copay down to like a $10 copay. So it made a big financial difference.
And of course, Lipitor is the largest selling anti-cholesterol drug medication out there?
Yeah.
So you said it went from about $300 a year to $100 a year?
A month.
Ooh, yeah, it's still not cheap.
Yeah.
I can tell you're not on Lipitor, Tom. I didn't know that one.
No, I mean, thank goodness I'm not.
But that's the cash price. So if you had insurance, it might have went from a brand copay down to a generic copay.
What are some of the other drugs that became eligible for generic?
Yeah, so this year, Plavix went generic, Seroquel, Diavan, Singulair, Lexapro. So those are some of the top 20 drugs.
All right, and Plavix is a drug used to prevent an anticoagulant, right?
So it helps keep the platelets from sticking together, yep.
Yeah, and so a lot of people who have had heart surgery are on Plavix. Is that why it's such a big seller?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, you know, most, I think when you've had a stent or you've had your coronary arteries fixed, they keep people on Plavix for 6 months or so. So it that's why it's such a big seller.
Yeah.
Let's change it up a little bit. And I know that this was, of course, not in your pharmacy, Dr. Cipolla, but one of the other news stories of this year had to do with the compounding pharmacy and the fact that this meningitis outbreak that has killed people across the country because of what happened at this compounding pharmacy. So explain to me first how a compounding pharmacy is different from a regular old pharmacy that you go to.
Right. So compounding has gone on for a long time. And at, you know, some regular pharmacies, they do compounding as well. But essentially compounding is combining, mixing, or altering ingredients to create a specific formulation to meet a specific patient's needs. And that has to be in response to a prescription and should be for limited quantities and based on just, you know, that one patient in that prescription. So what went on in New England, that pharmacy wasn't necessarily acting as a compounding pharmacy, but it definitely created a lot of problems.
So how did the patients end up with meningitis based on what went on at this pharmacy? How did that happen?
Well, it was contaminated. So they said the vials were contaminated with the fungus. So the drugs were being injected for pain relief into patients. And then patients went on to develop meningitis.
What do you suspect will come of this now? What are some of the regulations or things that might change? Are you hearing anything in your circles about what might change because of this tragedy?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of talk in Washington about what to do and kind of what the role of the FDA should be versus the Board of the Pharmacy, because right now the Board of the Pharmacy in each state oversee pharmacy operations, where the FDA oversees more of the manufacturing. And that seems to be, at least from what's been reported, more of what the pharmacy there was doing is manufacturing versus compounding.
Let me ask you about another topic, and that has to do with drug shortages. You know, during the year, we heard about various shortages of cancer drugs, antibiotics, drugs for ADHD. What's the problem there, and what happens to you as a pharmacist? How does it affect you, and what can we do about it?
Absolutely. So there has been a number of drug shortages this year. And some of that they think is due to it. And actually, if you notice, most of them are generic drugs that are having shortages. And so part of that is the profit margin isn't as high, so not as many companies are producing the generics. And then also problems with manufacturing. So similar to, you know, finding contaminants in a product, they might shut that product line down until they can fix that to keep the public safe. So that could create a shortage. Sometimes even the raw ingredients can be short. There's a number of reasons, but it definitely leaves the pharmacy and physicians scrambling to find an alternative in the meantime.
It almost seems impossible that someone who's diagnosed with cancer can't get the chemotherapy drugs that they need.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, isn't it interesting and disconcerting that what she said was that the drug company is going to concentrate and make sure they have made enough of the branded drugs, the drugs that are still on patent, and sometimes ignore the generic form of the drug that they have produced before because they don't make as much money on it. Now, you know,
that's trouble,
right?
Too.
Yeah.
OK, we've got a myth or matter of fact for you because we know how much you love these.
Okay.
Myth or matter of fact, it's risky to buy prescription drugs from online pharmacies or from Canada. Is that a risk that patients should take?
That is not a risk they should take. That's definitely a matter of fact. So you would want to make sure you're buying your pharmacies from a credible pharmacy that is licensed in the United States and in the state that they are operating. And really getting to know your pharmacist where you are can be a huge step of safety because you can ask questions and really they get to know you and you know them. And that can definitely provide an added level of security.
So you're not a big fan of ordering your prescription drugs over the internet?
No.
Dr. Amy Cipolla, pharmacist at the Mayo Clinic, thanks so much for being with us all the way from Dallas. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We'll enjoy the snow on your behalf.
Thanks.
All right. We've been reviewing the big medical stories of 2012. We talked about concussions with Dr. Ainsley Smith, breast cancer with Dr. Sandhya Pruthi. We talked about the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
Politics, yeah, with Kathleen Harrington. It was great to meet her, wasn't it? And new generic drugs with Mayo pharmacist Amy Cipolla. You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. It's a best of. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio, I'm giving you the weekend off.
Oh, that's so nice of you.
You're welcome. It's a best of. We'll repeat our program on gout with Dr. Clem Mache.
And you know what? We could have included gout in our top 20 or top stories of the year because gout is becoming more prevalent because of the obesity issue with everyone in this country. And the heavier you are, the more likely you are to get gout.
How did you know that? You must
have
been listening.
Well, I learned it from Dr. Clem Mache.
Well, you're absolutely right. Some of the risk factors are increased levels of fat and cholesterol, if you drink a little too much alcohol, or if you have a family history of gout. All of those contribute to it. But you know what? There is treatment, isn't there? And there's treatment for both the acute event and, you know, some people
long-term.
Say that that really hurts.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, our boss here at the radio station just wanted to cut his foot off, I think, when it happened to him. It's so painful.
Well, next week in the best of, we'll talk about treatment of the acute attack and prevention of further attacks, plus some lifestyle and home remedies to help prevent gout. Next week on Medical Edge Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website at radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to better manage your health.
You've been listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director is none other than Kim Davis.
Yee-hoo.
Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio and all of our wonderful guests who joined us today in studio and by telephone.
And all year long.
All right. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.